This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Good vroch to you. Before starting, I would like to extend a shalom aleichem, a welcome to Rabbi Franklin, who's served as a rabbi in South Africa for many years, in Durban, and afterwards in Sea Point, in Cape Town, and is now in Australia. Shalom aleichem, welcome, and good vroch. What I want to do this evening is, I thought there wouldn't be many people, because we didn't have a shiur last week, and we forgot to advertise this week, so I thought I would talk about Ayin Hara, which is... It's a subject that is shrouded in such mystique, and usually where there's a great deal of mystique, there's a great deal of ignorance, and people don't really know quite what it is, and it's become quite a superstition, even among quite intelligent people, and it's not a superstition at all. It's very, very simple. It's very basic. It's very rational, and if one understands the principles of it, it becomes one removes a bit of the mystique, but one understands the concept, one doesn't go meshuggah with it. What is an Ayin Hara? Where does it come from? How does one protect oneself against it? How does one use it effectively? Sometimes you want to use a delicious Ayin Hara, you want to use it. Yeah. I was going to discuss all that because I thought there would be very few people here. Now I'm not sure that I should, so that part of it anyway, to tell you how to use it, maybe we should keep in abeyance still. Firstly, the Ayin Hara, the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos that there are three things that distinguish a person as being a Talmid of Avraham Avinu and a Talmid of Bilam HaRosha. So we're not talking about genetic inheritance, we're not talking about what shows you as a descendant of Avraham or what shows you as a descendant of Bilam. There are many ways that one can identify a Jewish person. But we're talking about something more important than genetic, than the genes of being Jewish. The genes of being Jewish, that has certain halachic ramifications, and that's it. We're talking about something much more inherent than that. Whether one is a Talmid of Bilam or a Talmid of Avraham. Now, it's possible to be a Jewish and to be a Talmid of Bilam. That when Pirkei Avos gives us that, it's not telling us the distinction, a racial distinction. It's not saying there are Jews who are descended from Avraham, and there are others who are descended from Bilam. That's true, but that's a racial distinction. That's not what the Mishnah is concerned with. The Mishnah is concerned with a behavioral distinction. One which comes out of belonging to the school of Avraham, following the system of Avraham, the values of Avraham, or following the values and the system of Bilam. And they're both Jews. And how do you tell the difference? One would think it's not too difficult. One would think you've got to look at the syllabus that they study. If one studies Torah and one studies the science of witchcraft, then maybe one comes from Avraham and one comes from Bilam, but that's not what the Mishnah says. It doesn't say look at what they study. It doesn't say go into their library and see this for him. If they've got a Shas with Mishnayos, Mikros, Gedolos, Sifrei Musa, you know it's a Talmud of Avraham. If they've got books about witchcraft and cursing and all sorts of things, you know it's from Bilam. It doesn't say that. There are things you've got to look at inside the person to know whether he's a Talmud of Avraham or a Talmud of Bilam. You've got to look at the subject, not at the object. You can't look at the things he's got in order to know. You can't look at the things he knows. You can't look at his body of knowledge. You can't give him an exam where he has to answer certain questions in order to find out whether he's a Talmud of Bilam or a Talmud of Avraham. The way you find out are three middos. One of them is Ayin Tova. A good eye or a bad eye. Ayin Tova is descended from Avraham. An Ayin Ra, a bad eye, an evil eye, is descended from Bilam. Now there is Ruach Nemucho, Nefesh Shefela, certain modesty that has to go with it as well. We're not going to deal with the other two this evening. We're just going to deal with Ayin Tova and Ayin Ra. That means there's something about the eye of a person that can tell you whether he's descended from Avraham Avinu or whether he's a Talmud of Avraham Avinu, whether he's a disciple of the school of Avraham, or is a disciple of the school of Bilam. Now this Ayin Hara thing is quite serious. Gemara says in Bava Metzia, of Kuv Zayin, that Tishin v'tisho b'Ayin Hara, v'echod b'derech eretz. 99% of the people who die from Ayin Hara, and only 1% from natural causes. It's interesting. So when you see on a death certificate, it shouldn't say died from natural causes. 99%, if the doctors really knew what they were talking about, would say died from Ayin Hara. Every now and again, out of 100 cases, you'll find natural causes. A genuine heart attack or a genuine this or that. Most of it is ayin hara. That's frightening. Now, we've discussed before, and we'll go into it again at a later stage, not this evening. That means an ayin hara comes from someone else. You give somebody an ayin hara. It's ammunition. It's actually a form of attack. That means that 99% of deaths are caused by attack, by violence, by visual violence. That's a good name for ayin hara instead of this evil eye. Ayin hara is visual violence, VV. So that sounds a bit more medical, Dr. Sullivan. You can put there VV, cause of death, VV. It sounds more medical than saying ayin hara. People will think you're crazy if you say ayin hara. What does that visual violence mean? Somebody else did it. So Tosfos asks, in fact, on Bava Metzia, then the tribe of Yosef, ayin hara doesn't apply to them. We'll discuss later on why not. Ayin hara, they're protected from ayin hara, so says the Tosfos, that then the people of 99% of the descendants of Yosef should live for very long lives. At least 99 out of 100. All those that would normally have died from the ayin hara, if they're descended from Yosef, they're protected from ayin hara, and they should have extreme longevity, and we find that that's not so. So Tosfos says, no, then Hashem, with them it's natural causes. So when it's time to die, Hashem, it's not that the ayin hara makes a person die before his time. It's just the method that Hashem uses to bring about the death. It's not that somebody else caused the death. The death would have taken place in any case, and the proof is from the descendants of Yosef. There's no statistical difference in the longevity of the Bnei Yosef, the longevity of other people. So what does it mean then? That Hashem chooses ayin hara as the disease, as the mechanism with which to terminate a person's life. But we see how serious it is. So again, that doesn't mean that by protecting ourselves from ayin hara, we're going to live longer than planned. That also isn't so. But clearly, ayin hara is very dangerous. Ayin hara is very damaging. And what I'm interested in this evening is more how do we avoid ourselves using it, more than how do we avoid ourselves being afflicted by it. That's more important that we understand, because the difference of whether we're afflicted by it or not is not a major difference. The worst that can happen is that one suffers. That's the worst that can happen. But if you cause ayin hara, then it's a sign that you're from a Talmid of Bilam. It means that you're not part of the school of Avraham Avinu. That's much more serious. So instead of going out to such great extent as people often do, you'll see people wearing red things around there. If you see somebody wearing a red thing, the first thing you do is call a psychiatrist. Just find out if they have this. What's going on? Who's wearing a red thing around? Where did it come from? Where did he get it from? Who's ever seen such a thing? Everybody's busy. I was once sitting in an aeroplane and a tough, hardened businessman came up to me. And he says, you don't have to worry. I said, I don't have to worry about what? He said, about anything. I said, I'm not worried about anything. He says, aren't you worried the plane will crash? I said, no. He said, interesting, a lot of people are scared when they fly. But I'm telling you, you don't have to worry. I said, why not? He says, because I'm on the flight with you. I said, yeah, interesting. I said, and what chus do you have that's going to save us all? Took out of his pocket a kameya, a special little charm. He says, I was given this. I said, tell me, do you fast on Yom Kippur? He says, no, I don't. I said, do you keep Shabbos? He says, no. I said, do you keep Kashrus? No. He says, I eat treif on Yom Kippur. But he won't go around without his kameya, because some mashulach told him, if he's got his charm in his pocket, there'll be no ayin hara. Plane won't crash, he'll never die, he'll be well forever. A lot of nonsense. People approach it so irrationally. It isn't so at all. People are very worried about preventing the effect of ayin hara on themselves. I'm suggesting there's something much more important and much more significant. Prevent yourself being the cause of ayin hara. That's much more important. To prevent yourself being the affected by ayin hara, we'll discuss how you do that. And believe me, it's not by red threads, and it's not by carrying charms and wearing funny beads around your neck. That doesn't do it. There are other ways of doing it, but more important than that is to make sure that we're not the cause of ayin hara, that we don't cause visual violence, not that we're not affected by visual violence. The next thing that's interesting about ayin hara is that it's not a curse. Not at all. The Zohar gives us the recipe how to do it. Listen carefully. Toch hazoi, come have a look, says the Medrash, says the Zohar. It's on the parasha. Kol man deboi li staklo be'eno bisho. Anybody who wants to give an ayin hara, lo yochil, he cannot do it, ela, excepting if he follows the following. Kad meshabeach ve'oikir lahal milo deboi la'alto yebe'eno bisho. You've got to praise and value the thing that you're giving the Ayin Hara to. You can't give an Ayin Hara to something that isn't, that you don't value. You can't give an Ayin Hara to something that's not important to you. You can't give an Ayin Hara to something you don't admire. You've got to be full of admiration in order to give an effective Ayin Hara. And that's the danger of Ayin Hara. It doesn't come from our enemies, it comes from our friends. That's the danger. It doesn't come from people who hate us, it comes from people who like us and who admire us. That's the danger of Ayin Hara. And how do you do it? You say, Chamu kama tavada yosef. Look how wonderful this person is. Kama yoedo, how beautiful it is. Begin the yishlot be'ein obisho if you want the Ayin Hara to work. And that, says the Zohar, was part of Bilam's plan when he said, Ma tovu ahalech Yaakov. When Bilam was admiring us and he was praising us, do you think he was doing it for the brocha purpose? Yes, he really valued it and he really admired it, but his intention was to send out, to radiate Ayin Hara onto Klal Yisrael. And that's the way to do it. The way to do it is with admiration, not with negative thought. What is it? What brings it about? And how does one protect oneself against, firstly? The Chazal say, Rashi brings it, the second luchos, the second time that the Hashem gave the luchos, gave the tablets of stone to Moshe, says the second time, v'ish lo yale imach. Go quietly, climb up the mountain by yourself, nobody else should know, nobody else should be with you, come up the mountain, I'll give you the luchos. And Rashi says the first ones were with Kehilus and Baroki. The first one, there were loud voices, and there was thunder, and there was lightning, and there was trumpeting, and there was shofaris. There was a tremendous noise, there was enormous publicity. Sholta b'Ayin Hara. The Ayin Hara got the better of it. Even Matan Torah suffered as a result of Ayin Hara. The second one was done quietly. The second one was done without pomp and ceremony, without a lot of publicity. Nobody else went, only Moshe Rabbeinu went. And Rashi says at the end of that, Ein lecho yofe min hatznius. There's nothing more beautiful than tznius. Which means that three concepts are tied together. Yofi, beauty, tznius, modesty, and Ayin Hara. And that it's in fact in the beauty of tznius that the protection of Ayin Hara is to be found. And that's the only protection. It's in the beauty of modesty, and modesty is not the right word, as we've said several times before in the shir, that the tznius, the correct translation, is not modesty. The correct translation is hiding. Latznia, to hide something away. That the concept of hiding something, of hiding something away, is a concept of beauty, and one that is protective of the Yetzer Hara, of the Ayin Hara. Let's understand that briefly. We think, before that, let's analyze that. What is the Ayin Hara? The Ayin Hara interferes with bracha. That's the most important thing. Bracha is blessing. Blessing is to have more than you need, overflowing. That's bracha. To have what you need is not bracha. To have much more than you need, that's bracha. And what's the concept of giving somebody else a bracha? When Hashem sees that sincerely, that one person wants another to have more than he's got, that carries a lot of weight with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because it's unnatural. We don't normally want the other person to have more than they've got. When one sees that somebody really wants that, Hashem really genuinely wants another person to have more than he's got, the Ribbono Shel Olam reacts and he gives bracha. Ayin Hara interferes with the process of bracha. Ayin Hara damages the possibility, the potential for bracha. Ayin Hara, just as bracha, it results from two people being attracted to one another. That's why when you give a bracha, you put your hands on the other person. There's physical contact. A bracha is an act of attraction. That's why when Yitzchok wanted to give Esav a bracha, he told Esav to prepare him some food. Create a relationship, create a bonding, come close. Do something for me that I'll enjoy. And in response to that, I'll give you the bracha. A bracha is a relationship. A bracha is intimacy. A bracha comes from intimacy. There cannot be a bracha unless there's an intimate relationship between the mevorech and the one who's getting the bracha. It's the function of a close relationship where the one wants the other to have more. Ayin Hara is the opposite. Ayin Hara is one of repulsion, is one of a distance between two people. Now we think that the things that excite us also excite other people. So for example, if we buy a new motor car, an expensive, brand new, wonderful motor car, we're very excited, we enjoy it. It's a wonderful feeling. And you drive your new motor car out of the showroom, and it's a wonderful feeling. It's a feeling that only lasts for the first couple of days. After that, it's a second-hand car already. It's a new motor car only for a little while. But while you're driving the new motor car, what you hope most of all is that your friends will all pass you on the way. They'll all see you driving it. And your assumption is they'll enjoy it as much as you are. That it's important for them to see, not just to show off. Your assumption is that you're enjoying it, it's a pleasure, it's lovely, you want to share it with somebody, you want somebody else to see it, you want somebody else to share in that pleasure. Our assumption is that by communicating our celebrations, by communicating our achievements, that we are sharing them in an intimate way with other people. And there's a flaw in that assumption. It should be so, but it isn't so. It ought to be so, but it isn't so. If the other people are genuinely close or genuinely great, it will be so. But if the other people are ordinary people and their relationship with us is ordinary, it won't be so. And let's try and analyze it even a little further. I often tell a story because it has so much in it, and it taught me so much. It happened, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, when my wife said to me she wanted to go to an evening where there was a fellow selling pots. I said, what do you mean an evening? If you want to buy pots, you go to the Greatermans or whatever and you buy pots. An evening to go and buy pots? She said, no, there was a special pot, special guy, and he comes and there are a whole lot of ladies get together, like these Tupperware parties. It was before the time of the Tupperware parties. So I said, fine, you can go on one condition. I'm coming with. I struggle to get people to a shear on a night, in an evening. I want to see how a person gets people to come and buy pots in the evening. Because when I find out the secret of that, I'll be able to do anything. If I know how you can get women to come and buy pots in the evening, to give up of their time to come and buy pots, that's something I've got to see. So off we went, and this was in somebody's house. The place was packed. You couldn't get another person in. I think I was the only man there. And the salesman, he was there. And I watched this fellow very closely. And it was brilliant. And I've told the story often before, but it's something that one must always bear in mind because it explains the concept of tzniyus unbelievably. I thought, what's he going to do? There'll be a catalogue, there'll be pots, there'll be samples, he'll take orders, and finished, we'll be home in 15 minutes. No ways. He started giving a lecture. He lectured about food, he lectured about cooking, your mouth was watering by the time he finished, you just wanted to eat something. It was an unbelievable lecture. But most important of all is, on the table in front of him, there were what I assumed were pots, but they were covered in the most beautiful velvet coverings. They make the average challah decal look ridiculous. They were beautiful, they were gold embroidered, they were beautiful. Maroon and purples and dark blues, all different velvet coverings, and this just sat on the table for an hour and a half while he talked about cooking. Nobody was looking at him. Everybody was looking at the velvet coverings, wondering exactly what was up on top of them, underneath them. Then he came a little bit closer to his subject, and then he started talking about cooking and the different kinds of cooking and the different effects of cooking and how much depends on the pot. And when he got to just the right point in his talk, he whipped these coverings off the pots, and the women gasped. It's true. It's absolutely true. And what was on the table? A whole lot of pots. Ordinary, ordinary pots. And then he took his order book out and he started writing orders you can't imagine. There was only one lady who didn't order. That was my wife. And that wasn't because she didn't want to order the pots. That wasn't the reason she didn't. I just didn't let her. That wasn't the reason we went. We went for a learning experience, not to buy pots. What did I learn from that? That if you want somebody to be attracted to you or to your product, hide the product away. Or hide yourself away. The more mystique there is, the more it's covered, the more it's hidden, the more attractive it becomes. When you reveal, when it's out front, there's nothing attractive about it. It might be dramatic, it might be ostentatious, there might be a certain beauty to it, but there's a difference between beauty and attractiveness. Attractiveness occurs when a person wants to get closer. Beauty can occur when a person feels close enough. If I would walk by and the pots were just standing on the table, I wouldn't want to get closer to them. Not at all. I would have no desire to get closer to the pots. But when the pots were covered with these beautiful coverings, everybody wanted to get closer. Everybody wanted to rip the coverings off. That's an attractive dynamic. So during all the time that he was speaking, there was an attraction between him and his audience. Whereas if he was just trying to sell pots, it's like trying to sell insurance. You don't feel an attraction to the insurance salesman. He has a rough time. You want to get rid of him. And people who are selling it, salesmen have a very hard time. It's not something that the buyer automatically wants to embrace him and give him orders. It doesn't work like that. There's a certain defense that one puts up when you come to sell a person something. In that case, he'd overcome that. Not only had he overcome that defense, but he'd created a dynamic of attractiveness between his product and his audience by covering the product up. Now, we do that all the time without realizing that. When we give a gift, we go to a lot of trouble to wrap it. Doesn't it ever strike you, why do we do that? It's actually absurd when you look at it. A person buys a gift, and he goes and spends extra money on the wrapping paper, and he chooses the wrapping paper carefully, and the person wraps it up and puts a nice bow on it and everything, makes it look lovely. You give the gift, what's the first person, the person does? It rips the wrapping paper off. So why bother in the first place? Why spend the money and the time on wrapping something up when they're going to rip it off? Just give them the gift, finished. It wouldn't be the same. What wouldn't be the same? That moment of anticipation. When you give the gift over at that point and it's beautifully wrapped, there's a moment of attractiveness between, there's a dynamic of attractiveness between the recipient and the gift, and therefore between the recipient and the giver. If you would come with a gift, whatever it is, you give them a bottle of wine, you give them a pot, you give them a bowl. Imagine if it wasn't wrapped, you open your briefcase and you put out this bowl here, this is for you. Thanks for dinner, this is for you. What's the difference? It's not wrapped. Big deal, so it's not wrapped. Sorry, didn't have time to wrap it. The wrapping's very important. We understand that. We know that. It's that creates that air of anticipation. It's that creates that dynamic of attractiveness. It's that makes the person want the gift, no matter what's inside. The wrapping paper can make the person want it. And it's important before you give a gift to make the person want it. If the person wants it, whatever it is, he'll appreciate it. The person doesn't want it, you pull a bowl out of your briefcase, the first thing the woman thinks is, another bowl. But if it's a beautifully wrapped one, what does she think? Isn't that thoughtful? A gift. Lovely. She opens it up, a beautiful bowl. She's changed her whole attitude to it. She's changed her whole relationship to it because it's been presented properly. That's all. It's the same with people. It's the same with people. See, this is something which doesn't apply only to women, it applies to everybody, but applies a great deal to women, because that's the whole dynamic of attractiveness depends on the attractiveness of the woman primarily. And it's important for a woman to understand that in proper tzniyus, and by proper tzniyus I don't mean covering up again, because then a woman should just cover herself up with some kind of tent and then wander around like that. If it means covering, that's not what tzniyus means. It means hiding away. It means that mystical, romantic hiding away that creates an attractiveness other than the beauty. It's true, you can have a woman who has beauty, but that doesn't necessarily mean that she creates a dynamic of attractiveness as far as she and her husband are concerned. It doesn't necessarily mean that, and certainly as far as she and the rest of the world is concerned. Tzniyus does that. Tzniyus is not designed to make a woman unattractive. Tzniyus is designed to enhance a woman's attractiveness, not to impair it, to enhance the attractiveness of femininity. If it was so that tzniyus was designed to damage the attractiveness of a woman, we wouldn't have to have laws of yichud. Then there would be no law prohibiting a man and a woman to be alone together. If when women were dressed properly, they were unattractive, what would you need laws of yichud for? The fact that there are laws of yichud, even when a woman is dressed properly, means on the contrary, that the proper dressing doesn't detract from her attractiveness. On the contrary, it adds to the attractiveness. And that's part of the nature of tzniyus. And tzniyus applies, as we see many times in Chazal, not only in the way we dress, in the way we walk, in the way we carry ourselves, in the way we conduct ourselves. There's a certain attractiveness to it. When the other person wants to get to know you better, that's attractiveness, and that's what tzniyus encourages. The dynamic of the ayin hara results from a person admiring rather than being attracted. When I see you driving by in your brand new motor car and I look at it, I think, gee, that's a beautiful motor car. It is. And you look wonderful in it. It is. And I'm happy for you, and I am. But deep down there's a questioning. How come he's made it and I haven't? How come he can afford it and I can't? What's he got that I haven't got? Just a little questioning that goes together with all that admiration. And that creates a negative dynamic. That's a distancing dynamic. It's not bringing us closer. It's actually creating a distance. And that distance is the seed of Ayin Hara. That distance, when Hashem gives a person bracha, and you go driving down the road in your bracha, and somebody else looks at it and says, why does he deserve it? That interferes with the process of bracha. Then the Ribbono Shel Olam also starts questioning it. If that's the way people feel about you, then that's a good question why you deserve it. Why do people feel that way about you? And then the bracha starts getting damaged, and then the potential for bracha is damaged. So, Ayin Hara comes from revealing, from ostentation, from display, from being totally upfront. Brocha in lecha, brocha ela besomei min ha'ayin. Brocha is found by things that aren't seen. In order for there to be brocha, there needs to be modesty, there needs to be tzniyus, it needs to be somewhat hidden in order for brocha really to exist. The Gemara says several times that Yosef and his descendants are not affected by Ayin Hara. What is it? What have they done that protects them from Ayin Hara? The Zohar says also on the Parsha, Vayar Yisrael Sheichein Lishvotov. And he saw Yisrael camped according to their tribes. Mahu Sheichein Lishvotov, asked the Zohar. What does that mean? Elo Shivta de Yosef Havetamon, the Shivta de Binyamin. He wasn't interested in the others. He focused on two, Yosef and Binyamin. The Loishalta Buhaina Bisha, where there's no Ayin Hara. Omar Ho Rosha, that Rosha said, Ono Ava Shurodo, the Loiskaya. I will focus on these two and I will wipe them out. So this became a battle between the master of Ayin Hara and the two Shvotim that excelled in defense of Ayin Hara. So you had Binyamin and Yosef who were able to ward off Ayin Hara. And you've got the master, Bilam, the arch rebbe of the Talmidim of Ayin Hara, of people who wanted to learn this, the arts of Ayin Hara. And the Rav Zohar goes on to say, Rochel havas toman. Rochel was there. Chamos de'ena de'ho roshu mishanan ala avavsho. The spirit of Rochel was present, and she noticed that this wicked man was about to apply his evil eye to her children. Nafkas ufrishas godfo alayhu. She came out and she spread her wings over them and she protected them. The Chofas al Baro, and she protected her children. What has Rachel got to do with it? What has Yosef got to do with it? What of Binyamin? What has this part of the family got to do with Ayin Hara? That goes back to an earlier Zohar where the Zohar tells us the background. It starts at the time that Yaakov was coming back back home after being with Lavan. And he meets Esav on the road. You remember the whole story. He was worried about Esav. And there's a meeting that takes place. Esav says, what does it say in the Torah? He lifted up his eyes, Esav, and he looked at the women and the children, and he said, who are these? Yaakov answers, the children have been given to me by Hashem. He doesn't comment about the women, signifying to us that that question was improper. Come and see. Ho, Rosh of the Esav Yav Inu Le'eino Al Noshim. Esav was eyeing the women. Uvegine Iskin Tikune Yaakov. And therefore Yaakov rearranged his camp. Shavi Shvochus Bekadmai. So first he put the Shvochus, the servants, Uvneon Levosar, and then their children. Leo Abasrayu, then came Leah, Uvno Labosar, then came her children, Labosar Yosef, and afterwards came Yosef, Uvosra Rochel, and then Rochel, Vahu Oval Ifnaim, and Yaakov went in the front, so he put Rochel right at the back, so that Esav wouldn't see her. Kad Sagidu Kula Maksiv, it says here, the Zohar then points out that there's a difference in the psukim. At one point, Yosef is placed at the very back. At another point, he comes and bows down in front of his mother. What exactly happened? Elo bro tovo, bro rechimo, tzaddik of the army, Yosef. This good son, this kind son, this tzaddik of the world, Yosef. Kivan dechamo ine deharosho mistagel benoshin. When he noticed, look how observant they were. When he noticed from Esav's question and from his eye that he was eyeing the women, dochil alime, he worried about his mother. Nofik me'abaso, he came out from behind her, uforish derui v'gufe v'chasi olo, and he spread out his body and his arms and protected her, stood in front of her, that he shouldn't see her. begin the lo yiten ho rosha einoy beimay, so that rosha shouldn't apply his eyes to rocha because he was worried about ayin hora. Kamo itzagi, how much did he expand? Shis amin lechol stas, 6 amos each way. That's about what, 10 feet? About four meters. Is that right? About 4 meters in each direction. He put on a lot of weight very, very quickly. The chofo aloi protected over lo yochel ein da rosho l'shalto alo, and as a result of that, Esav's eye was not able to protect her. Later on, the Zohar comes back to them to this issue and says, "Bekadmiso bro chofo alime." In the beginning, the son protected the mother. V'hashto, now when Bilam comes along, imo chofo sabro, it's the mother who comes and protects the children. At that time that Yosef protected Rochel, his mother, Hashem said, you should know that if anybody comes to apply an ayin hora to my children, this Rochel, the mother, will protect them. You protected your mother, your mother will protect them. So here we have a case of Yosef recognizing the power of ayin hora, fearing for the safety of his mother. So look, they regard this as something like a physical attack. And he takes the same kind of proportions. He stands in front of his mother. He expands himself enormously, protects her from the vision of Esav. Esav can't see her, and she doesn't get affected by it. Hashem says as a result of that, come the time when she'll protect her children, and she protects Yosef and Binyamin from the eye of Bilam. Why Rochel? Why her children? Why Yosef and Binyamin? Let's go back to perhaps the greatest deed of Rochel. You remember when Yaakov wanted to marry Rochel, the whole deal he made with Lavan. Lavan cheats Yaakov and puts Leah under the chuppah instead of Rochel. And Chazal tell us, of course, Rochel and Yaakov suspected that that's what Lavan would do. They knew what a crook he was. So they'd made a secret arrangement. Under the chuppah, there was a password that Rochel was given by Yaakov, and she was told, under the chuppah, this is the password you say, and then I'll know that it's you. If I don't get the password, I'll know that it's somebody else. They stand under the chuppah. It's Leah. In those days, they wore a veil that you couldn't see through. There was no way Yaakov could know, but she gave the password. That was enough. So he knew that it was Rochel. What's the background? Say Chazal, Rochel pictured to herself Leah walking down the aisle and walking up to the chuppah and the Rav standing there and about to say, here's the ring, and say Areyat Mekudeshes, and all the people standing about, and Yosef would be listening for the password and there would be no password. Yaakov would have to say, sorry, the wedding's cancelled. And Rochel pictured her sister walking back down the aisle, and she wasn't willing to have that. And bear in mind that at that time she didn't know that Yaakov would be free, never mind willing, to marry her as well. Because the din is you can't marry two sisters. It was an extreme, exceptional case that Yaakov married Rochel and Leah. So when Rochel gave that password to Leah, as she did, as Leah was about to walk to the chuppah, she whispered in her ear and she said, when you're standing on that chuppah, say the password, otherwise it won't work. When she gave her sister that password, she believed she was giving up any chance of ever marrying Yaakov. How did she do it? What was it that enabled her to do it? The ability to celebrate in somebody else's success, even when that success ought to have been yours. It's hard enough to celebrate somebody else's success when they deserve it. When somebody else has really worked for what they've got, and they deserve what they've got. To be able to celebrate with them and enjoy it as if it's your own, and that's as we said last night, what the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamecha really means. To be able to celebrate your friend's successes, your friend's simchas, your friend's achievements, your friend's joys, as if they're yours, with the same degree of simcha. That's hard enough. Can you imagine when your friend is celebrating something that ought to have been yours, that was taken away from you deceitfully, that you worked for, not him, and he's celebrating what ought to be yours, for you still to participate and help and take a part in that, what that is? Rochel conquered the very concept of ayin hara. She destroyed it totally. A person who's able to do that can't be affected by ayin hara. A person who's capable of doing that creates children like Yosef in Binyamin. Somebody like Yosef is in turn able to protect his mother from ayin hara. That part of the family, Rochel and her two children, developed the capacity to outwit the Ayin Hara. But from such Mesirus Nefesh it came. That's how you do away with the Ayin Hara. You don't want to be affected by Ayin Hara, the little red thread doesn't help. And that's why these little red threads are supposed to come from the Kever Rochel. So that's the whole story. You've got to walk around the Kever Rochel with this red thread, and then you go and sell it. And if you haven't walked around Kever Rochel, then you say you've walked out around of Kever Rochel. It doesn't really matter. But it's supposed to come from Kever Rochel, because that's the important part, the connection with Rochel. So what's become the Iker? Everybody grabs the red thread. The red thread's not what's important. What's important is the identification with the value system of Rochel. What is the value system of Rochel? To be able to celebrate your competitor's success. That's what the value system of Rochel is. You know what that is? To celebrate your competitor's success? Doesn't help wearing a red string and wishing that your competitor would drop dead. That's not how one protects oneself from Ayin Hara. That red string is meant to signify that I have absorbed within myself the qualities of Rochel. And if one wears the red string without having absorbed those qualities, that's a terrible thing. That's completely deceitful. And that draws even more attention and more Ayin Hara to oneself. Because that's gaiva. That's yura. That's saying to somebody, look at me, I'm also like Rochel. Well, you're not. That's not the important thing. The internal thing is the important thing. The ability to really identify with her value system. To develop the capacity to celebrate the success of a competitor. That's what has to be there. And that's hard. But that's the way we protect ourselves from Ayin Hara. And where does that come from? It comes from an enormous sense of self-security. You can't celebrate the success of your competitor if you're not very secure within yourself. If a person's insecure, there's no way he can. So the source of the Ayin Hara, the source of the ability of the Ayin Hara to affect one, to affect and to be affected by it, lies in insecurity. The feeling of resentment that somebody else has got something, and the feeling that if they've got it, I haven't got it, if they've got it, it's at my expense, which is of course nonsensical, but that's what people feel. There's some kind of feeling, if somebody else has achieved something, it's kind of on my cheshbon. In Rachel's case, it really was on her cheshbon. The chances were that she wouldn't get Yaakov, and still she was able to celebrate. How much more so we need to be able to celebrate when it's not on our cheshbon, but we're not paying for it. Why not be able to celebrate? And it comes from needing to measure oneself against other people, which is the society in which we live. There is a competitiveness in us, and there's nothing wrong with that competitiveness. Competitiveness drives one. Competitiveness enables us to achieve. The question is, who are we competing against? In Western society, we're competing against each other. And that's where the Ayin Hara flourishes. In a society where people are competing against each other, there's enormous room for Ayin Hara. It's not necessary to be competing against one another. One should be competing against one's own potential. That's all that's important. That's where the focus should be. And if I recognize my potential and I set my standards by my potential, not by your potential or your achievements, that's totally irrelevant to me. There's only one thing that's relevant to me. What am I capable of and how well am I doing in terms of that capability? That's what's important. And we start teaching children that early on. We start teaching children when they come back with marks from school. And we start asking them how they did. And they say they got 85%. You say, little so-and-so, how much did he or she get? 89%. Why didn't you get 89%? Also, you're not encouraging the child to achieve his or her greatest potential. You're simply encouraging the child to beat the daylights out of the competition. And sports is the same kind of thing. And then business becomes the same kind of thing. The excitement and the go and the concept of winning is to win means that you win at somebody else's expense. And that's the pleasure of it. That's not meant to be the pleasure of it. The pleasure of it is, yes, there needs to be a competitiveness. That's fine. That's why we've got a Yetzer Hara. We've got enough within ourselves to fight. We've got enough within ourselves to battle. We've got enough within ourselves to conquer. We don't need outsiders to conquer. We don't have to feel good at the conquests we make outside of ourselves. The greatest conquests we make are inside. That's why the Mishnah says, Ezehu Gibur HaKovish Yisitzrei. When are you really a Gibur? When are you really powerful? When you're able to conquer yourself. That's when you've really achieved great power. Because there's no enemy that's as strong as you are. There's no competitor that's as worthy of the competition as you are yourself. So compete with yourself, stop competing with other people. And in an environment where we measure our own success by how much we've been able to beat our competitor, that's an environment where Ayin Hara is rife. Because when you're not winning, when you see somebody else winning, that feels like a loss. That means I'm losing. If somebody else wins, I'm losing. That's not an environment in which one can do away with any sense of Ayin Hara. What was it that Bilam saw in Klal Yisrael. As we said last night, one of the things that he saw was, particularly in the third vision that he has, when it says that same piece that the Zohar quoted, Vayaris Yisrael Shoichin Lishavotov, and he saw Yisrael camped by their tribes. Vatehi Olov Ruach Elokim. So the Zohar takes that to mean, and there was at that time the spirit of Hashem was on Bnei Yisrael. That was the spirit of Rochel that we've just talked about. But the Rashi and Chazal in other places take it no. Vatehi Olov Ruach Elokim. There was the spirit of Hashem came upon Bilam himself. What was it that he saw that brought about that spirit of Hashem? So he's busy admiring them, and we're afraid that his very admiration is going to bring about the Ayin Hara which he wants to put on them. So the Mor of Hashemesh says the following. As we know, one of the things he says further on is that he saw that Ein Pischehim B'chuvonim Ze Keneged Ze, that the way they constructed their tents was so that people didn't look into each other's homes. But no two doors or windows were opposite each other. Everybody had privacy. One can explain this, that their tents weren't opposite each other. There's a principle, says the Mor of Hashemesh. Every tzaddik should discover his own approach in Kedusha. And he should make his own openings, his own ways in. And not to imitate the approaches of other people. For example, imitating your Rebbe. Saw your Rebbe doing something, so you do the same thing. You saw your friends doing something, so you do the same thing. Now this is a very narrow line and something very, very critical. Because on the one hand, we talk about the importance of Masoris, of things being handed down from generation to generation. And on the other hand, the Mor of Hashemesh is talking very importantly about not imitating. There's a big difference between remaining authentic and between imitating. And we've lost the ability to discern between those two. And imitation has become the style of the way we do things, not only in the Torah world, but in the secular world, it's exactly the same. Imitation is a big force. Fashion is dominated by imitation. Not just fashion in clothing, fashion in styles and everything that we do, and in the way we do things, there's an enormous force on people to imitate what's being done elsewhere and what's being done by others. But it's affected the Torah world as well. And the Mor of Hashemesh says that's not the way. Yes, you've got to take your approach from your Rebbe, you've got to take the basics, the principles, but you've got to take that and use that to innovate yourself something which is on the one hand authentic and on the other hand is original. It's not the right way to imitate. Each one must find his own openings and his own gateways to Kedusha. And that's what Bilam understood. It wasn't just that their tents were constructed with privacy. He saw the way they operated. There was innovation. There was originality. Each family, each tribe, each yeshiva, each Beis HaMedrash had its own way of doing things. People didn't go and peep into each other's way to see what they were doing. Let's see what this yeshiva is learning and how they're learning, and let's see what this Beis HaMedrash is doing, and let's do the same thing and into each other's homes. That wasn't important. Each one wanted to find his own way. That's why there was the spirit of Hashem that descended, either, as the Zohar wants to say, on them, that this enabled them to protect themselves from Ayin Hara. And here we have the essence of the method of protection from Ayin Hara. We said, yes, Tzniyus protects from Ayin Hara. And we've said that doing things, not being ostentatious, and that being able to celebrate other people's success, that's all true. But what is the source of all that? What enables the human being to feel secure enough to celebrate other people's success? What enables the person to feel secure enough to hide his own successes? It's exactly the other way around. What we would like to do is hide everybody else's successes and publicize our own. And what we're asking ourselves to do is punt faked, exactly the opposite. If you want to be protected from Ayin Hara, hide your own success and publicize everybody else's. Imagine what would happen to the marketing world if that's what happened. If Pick and Pay put up big notices, don't come to us. It's true, you know, we're good, but they're better. Go to Checkers, try them. And Checkers said, why try us? Pick and Pay are the leaders in the field. Try them. Imagine if that kind of advertising, it wouldn't impact badly on business. Both Pick and Pay and Checkers would be known equally well. Pick and Pay would advertise Checkers, and Checkers would advertise Pick and Pay. Vodacom would advertise MTN, and MTN would advertise Vodacom. Imagine such a thing. Imagine such a society in which that would happen. They're still talking about introducing the legitimizing negative advertising. That you're allowed to talk about other people's products negatively. They're about to make that legal in South Africa, similar to the way they've made it in the United States. And they've got some very good arguments for it. But imagine if we did it the other way around, that you're only allowed to advertise somebody else's products, and every company has to devote at least 10% of their revenue to advertising competitors' products. Imagine what a world that would be. That's the way one has to be if one wants to avoid ayin hara. That you don't measure yourself against somebody else. Let them do well too. I've got to do well in terms of my own potential. I don't have to worry about what they're doing. On the contrary, I can encourage them, I can develop them as well. What gives me the security to be able to do that? Says the Mor of Hashemesh, the Koach HaChidush, the ability to be innovative. If one's dependent on imitation, there can be no protection from the ayin hara. If I'm dependent on imitation, I've got to watch what everybody's doing. And if they do it before me, that's a problem. And if they do it better than me, that's a problem. If I'm dependent on imitation, I've got to knock the opposition. I've got to knock the competition. Because I'm imitating them, and the only way I can be better than them is if I get rid of them. If I knock them down, that's the only way I can be any better than them. That's not going to protect anybody from ayin hara. One wants to protect from ayin hara, there has to be such innovation within ourselves that we feel protected. There's nobody. We're not in the business of imitating. And we understand that our ability lies in our innovative abilities, and therefore we can't be imitated because innovation can't be imitated. By the time they're imitating me, I'm onto something new, I'm onto something different. Only with a Koach HaChidush, with the ability to create something new, does the person really develop the ability to protect himself from ayin hara. And everybody has the Koach HaChidush. Everybody can be mechadish. Not everybody can be mechadish in a Rambam. Not everybody can be innovative in a piece of Rambam or in a piece of Gemara. Tanu Chochem can, other people can't. But each person can be innovative in their own field of expertise. What's important is that everybody has a field of expertise, whatever that field is. It might be in cooking, it might be in raising children, it might be in an area of business, it might be in a specialized area of a profession, it might be in anything, it might be in one's hobby, in one's work, in one's learning, in one's davening. But everybody has to have a speciality in which they're not imitating. An area in which they're mechadesh, an area in which they're developing their own new ideas. Because without that, there can't be that true sense of security. Without that, there can't be a true acknowledgement of the godliness within me. The godliness is the ability to be boire, the ability to create. That's godliness. And if I'm not creative, there's no godliness that I can be aware of. And if I'm not aware of the godliness within me, I've got to be very worried about what's going on around me and what everybody else is doing. And that's the society in which we're living. We're living in a non-innovative society, where everything is measured simply in terms of winning or losing compared to competitors. And that's not one that can be protective of ayin hara. And that's part of the essence of Yiddishkeit. Yiddishkeit, as we've so often said, is not just the very important areas that we always stress. Our Shabbos, our Kashrus, our Taras HaMishpocha, our Limud HaTorah, our Davening, all these things. They're all part of a whole. The core of that whole is the ability to feel within oneself the sense of security that comes from knowing that within me I have a spark of the Ribbono Shel Olam. I have a spark of the Ribbono Shel Olam within me. No, if I've got the spark of the Ribbono Shel Olam, I have to use it, I have to develop it. And in some area or another, I have to be at the forefront, I have to be mechadesh, I have to be innovative. That gives me a sense of security. And why is that sense of security so important? Because when I have that sense of security, I stop peeping into other people's houses. I stop looking over my shoulder to see where everybody else is. That's what, if you watched, you remember we watched the Comrades Marathon, watched a few minutes of it. The runners don't look ahead. They're looking behind every few minutes. That's all that's important to them. It's not the guy in front that's important to whether he can break a record. The guy in front is the only one who has as one of his aims measuring himself against himself. But everybody else is measuring themselves against the people in front and the people behind. And that's our lives. That's how we go through our entire lives, watching behind them, watching all around to see where everybody else is holding. Who cares where everybody else is holding? What's important is where I'm holding. And if each person will value themselves enough to know what their potential is, and to focus on their potential, and to develop their potential, and to become creative and innovative with that potential, then we'll develop a sense of security. We will develop a feeling of Rochel, not just a little red thread around our wrists, but we'll really begin to identify with Rochel's value system. Rochel's value system, the ability to celebrate the victories and the successes not only of our friends but even of our competitors, to celebrate them as if they are our own, to participate in them and to help them achieve in them. That's the midah of Rachel. And when we're able to do that, we'll be able to become mitalmidov shel Avraham Avinu. Then we're joining the school of Avraham Avinu. To join the school of Avraham Avinu, as we said at the outset, is not determined by how many mesechtas you've learned. It's not determined by how many hours a day you're learning. It's not determined by how you daven. It's not determined by what you eat. Those are all important things. But that's not what determines whether you come from the school of Avraham Avinu or not. Ayin Tova. The ability to look nicely at things. To be able to look at the pleasures and the joys and the successes and the beauty of other people and to celebrate them and enjoy them. And it's such a selfish thing to do apart from anything else. It's something which gives a lot of nachas. Because a person in his lifetime has a certain amount of pleasure. He has a certain amount of joy. And the Mishnah Sishorim says in the beginning, it's not an awful lot. If you work out how much we have to struggle for our little bits of pleasure, it's not an awful lot of pleasure that we've got. When we have the ability to share other people's pleasure, life's a different thing. And every time somebody else has a simcha, I can also enjoy it. Every time somebody else has achieved something, I can also enjoy it. If we develop that capacity, apart from the fact that we develop an ayin hara free society, apart from that, we also develop a capacity for joy that far outweighs what we previously have. So not only is it important for society and for community life to be able to develop the midah of Rochel, that midah of being able to celebrate the success of others, but it's important for our own joy and for our own success. It's that brought Bilam to say with agonizing admiration, Matuvu Ohalecho Yaakov, how beautiful is your privacy. That's how that should be translated. It's not talking only about your homes, and it's not talking about only about your Beis HaMedrash. If we take that posuk with the Chazal on it and translate its true meaning, what Bilam is saying is Matuvu Ohalecho Yaakov, how beautiful are your private places, Yaakov. The way you've been able to retain privacy. Perhaps that's the best translation for tznius, rather than modesty. Perhaps tznius should best be translated as privacy. A privacy which keeps an attractiveness. A privacy which enables you, or which is symptomatic of your ability to celebrate the successes and joys of other people. A privacy which is symptomatic of your own inner security, of your own belief that you're able to achieve within yourselves. Of your own belief that you don't need to knock the competition. Of your own belief that you're measuring yourselves against yourselves all the time, not against other people. Matuvu Ahalecha Yaakov. How goodly is your privacy, Yaakov.